This is Bloomberg Best.
Bloomberg Best is about the insight and the context that we get from our guests.
It's a great way to catch up on some of the stories you might have missed on the Bloomberg.
Stories you're not going to find in any other news organization.
Bloomberg Best. Bloomberg's best stories of the day. Powered by 2,600 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries around the world.
I'm June Grosso.
And I'm Ed Baxter on this edition of Bloomberg Best for Thursday, May 25th.
We speak to the Nigerian oil minister about a nine-month extension to OPEC production cuts.
I support the nine-month straight off. I think it gives a longer gestation period to see how prices move, how stocks stay, how the reserves most countries are holding up.
And former HHS Secretary Kathleen Sebelius discusses the current state of Obamacare.
The current administration is actively sabotaging the marketplace and then throws up their hands every time a company announces withdrawal.
All this and more coming up in the next hour of Bloomberg Best.
House Republicans got a dose of bad news yesterday after the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office said the revised American Health Care Act would undermine insurance markets and deprive 23 million more Americans of health care coverage. Kathleen Sebelius is the former HHS secretary under President Obama, and she spoke with Bloomberg's David Gura.
Let me just start with your reaction to what we learned yesterday from the CBO. You're no stranger to looking at CBO scores. What stood out to you from the report yesterday?
Well, I think, David, what we learned is what people had thought about the American Health Care Act passed by the House Republicans. About 23 million people will lose coverage, and in spite of the protestations by House Republicans, the CBO says very clearly this does not protect people with pre-existing conditions. It does not. And I think that makes it a very difficult bill. It could not only cause millions and millions of people to lose coverage, but certainly older Americans, anybody with a pre-existing condition, anybody with a chronic condition, is going to be in really difficult shape under this bill. If they can get coverage, they may be priced out of the market, and some of them could be blocked out of the market altogether. Lower income folks will find their premiums going up because the subsidies are cut. And as I say, if you're older, the age tax is a 5-to-1 ratio. So somebody who's above 50 years old could get charged 5 times as much. And they're saying if you're older and lower income, it could be an 800% increase in the premium you're paying right now.
What do you say to Americans who see health insurers pulling out of marketplaces around the country and feel worried about the integrity or the future of the Affordable Care Act? What's your prescription for what needs to happen to get insurers to stay in those marketplaces or in some cases come back to them?
Well, I'm a believer that the current administration is actively sabotaging the marketplace and then throws up their hands every time a company announces withdrawal and appears to be surprised. They can do a couple of things immediately. They don't have to wait for Congress. They should make it clear that the subsidies in the law will be paid and continue to be paid. That's a big deal for insurance companies to follow the law. They should make it clear that the individual penalty charged to people who can afford to buy coverage, who refuse to participate, that penalty will be enforced by the IRS. Again, that's the law of the land, and this administration can make that clear. And third, they could use some of their bully pulpit power to talk to insurers, to convince people, particularly in some of those markets where there's not enough competition, to actually participate, look at the risk corridors, help state regulators move in that direction instead of what really has been for the last 120 some odd days an active sabotage of the existing market, which makes it very unclear what will happen to the 12.2 million Americans who currently have marketplace coverage.
We've seen all of this play out in a cauldron of politics. Healthcare reform play on a cauldron of politics. Why is it so difficult, do you think? You're not in Washington full time anymore. You spent a lot of time there, though. Why is it hard to have smart conversations about healthcare? Why does this become politicized and so entrenched in politics so quickly?
Well, it's been entrenched in politics since this debate began under President Obama. If you recall, there were Republicans who participated very actively in the 15 months of House and Senate hearings and lots of amendments, and then didn't vote for the bill. The day the president signed the Affordable Care Act into law, we were sued by 27 state attorneys general. Even when the Supreme Court found the law to be constitutional, politics continued to play out through the 2012 reelect. I was really hopeful at that point it would be over. Then people would say, this is the law of the land, let's move on. But that has never happened. We've never had a Congress who participated in trying to fix the law, make it work better, but instead the House voted before President Trump 51, 52 times to repeal the Affordable Care Act. So the politics of the last 120 days aren't a surprise. What I think is incredibly disappointing, though, is how cruel the replacement for the Affordable Care Act would be, how hard it would fall on people who desperately need health insurance and need some financial stability in their lives, and secondly, how actively this administration has worked to undermine the current marketplace.
That was former HHS Secretary Kathleen Sebelius speaking with Bloomberg's David Gura.
Coming up, we'll be speaking with the former chairman of the Export-Import Bank of the U.S.
You can see all the Bloomberg Best Stories at Best Go. This is Bloomberg. During the campaign, President Trump took a tough stance on trade. But as president, he's tempered his promises on an American First trade agenda with countries like China and Mexico. For more, Bloomberg's David Westin and Jonathan Farrow talk with Fred Hochberg, former chairman of the Export-Import Bank of the U.S.
Let's start with NAFTA, because we just got notice under NAFTA. There's been a lot of talk about Mexico. Take us through what you understand is the process of renegotiating NAFTA, and what is the good that can come out of it, and what are the risks?
Well, there's a process in terms of notice to Congress and a very deliberate process. A lot of the open issues with NAFTA, the difficulties with NAFTA is, first of all, let's remember, it was done 25 years ago. The world has changed. The digital economy wasn't anticipated, cross-border banking and so forth. None of these things were really in the original agreement. So it's very rare for any agreement to last for 25 years without needing adjustment.
So you think it's a good time to take another look at it?
Absolutely a good time. TPP, actually, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, addressed a lot of the flaws, a lot of the things that needed to be remedied in NAFTA. And I imagine that a number of the issues in the Trans-Pacific Partnership will be part of this negotiation with Canada and Mexico. We also have to remember one thing. I mean, I traveled to Mexico many, many times as Ex-Im chairman. Canada and Mexico are our two largest trading partners, the two largest destinations for U.S. goods and services. So this is a vital trade relationship we want to be careful not to upset. You know, we sell more goods and services to those two countries than probably the next dozen after them.
So is it possible that as a result of renegotiating NAFTA, there actually might be more cross-border trade with Mexico rather than less?
If we do it smartly. I mean, one of the key issues we have to be very careful about, we've established really good supply chain relationships where components may be made in Canada or Mexico, sent to the United States, maybe sent back to Mexico, finished goods here. And it is a way that North America, Mexico, the United States, and Canada can effectively compete with Asian competitors because we've got a much bigger market. We can draw from both natural resources and human capital across those three countries. So we've got to be careful.
Let's put into the mix this border adjustment tax and how it would fit with a NAFTA renegotiation. And it's not clear whether it's going to go forward or not. I mean, the House Republicans say absolutely. The Senate Republicans say absolutely not. But how would it fit with NAFTA?
Well, first of all, I would say the intelligence I've been gaining over the last couple of days is this tax is not going to happen.
Yeah.
I think there is no enthusiasm for it. There may be some lip service people have to say, but there's a lot of rolling of eyes when the subject comes up. First of all, it has not been done. Secondly, it may not be compliant with the World Trade Organization. It may not be legal. And you mentioned just earlier on the show, we've got a lot, there are a lot of delicate issues going on between the United States, Mexico, and Canada, the United States in trade, and the global economy. This is a very disruptive type of tax. It's not been used. It's not used in developed countries. We don't have a value-added tax. We don't have the kinds of things that would coincide with the border adjustment tax. So it's a little bit of an oddball to throw in. I think, and I think many people in Washington think, this was a way of finding $1 trillion to justify tax cuts elsewhere. It's not really a good idea, but we got to find the cash someplace. We're not finding it through the repeal of Obamacare. We're not finding a border. So there's a sort of a scramble for cash.
That was Fred Hochberg, former chairman of the Export-Import Bank of the U.S., speaking with Bloomberg's David Westin and Jonathan Farrow. And speaking of the world economy, now let's go to Bloomberg's Emma Chandra and Hillary Clark for a look at how the Bloomberg Terminal can help make sense out of some of the news stories from the week.
We're going to discuss China. This after a surprise move by Moody's to downgrade the country's credit rating. That was the first time Moody's has downgraded China since 1989. Hillary, were you even born then?
I'm going to plead the fifth on that.
Okay, we'll let you get away with that this time. Moody's cited slowing growth and ballooning levels of debt for their downgrade. And actually, total borrowing has surged to 260% of gross domestic product at the end of last year. Hillary, you've been digging into the terminal for some charts and functions to help tell this story.
I really wanted to take a look at why this downgrade happened, or rather the fundamentals of the downgrade. So I have a chart highlighting this debt load. If we take a look at G#BTV1009, the bars on the chart represent all the financing in China, clearly in an upward trend. I overlaid this with GDP growth. We can see the clear downtrend in the GDP growth since 2010 compared with that skyrocketing debt issuance.
What's interesting actually is that part of Moody's calculation for the downgrade was that Chinese policymakers' efforts to reduce leverage in the financial system wasn't happening quickly enough. Now, Hillary, your charts point to the potential for liquidity problems in China. Can we break down debt issuance any further?
Moody's is forecasting that economy-wide debt of China will continue to increase from 256% of GDP at the end of last year, as you said. I just want to emphasize that's economy-wide, not just in corporate and government debt, as people might assume. So if you want to narrow this down to the consumer or household loans, I have another chart for you. That's G#BTV8830. I have median income growth for Chinese families. That's declining to 6.7% from 10% at the beginning of 2016. I overlaid this with mortgage loan growth, on the other hand, which is at 35% year over year. That's up from 30% during the middle of 2016. There's a clear inverse trend between these two metrics that just points to the fact that the credit issue is in all facets of the economy.
That was Bloomberg's Emma Chandra and Hillary Clark.
Coming up, amid a banking exodus from the UK, we'll speak with the CEO of the London Stock Exchange.
You can see all the Bloomberg Best stories at Best Go. This is Bloomberg.
This is a Bloomberg Quick Take. Context and background on issues of interest.
Our focus is on Qatar and why it still wants to be an outsized player, with Bloomberg's Mohammed Sergi.
The situation.
Qatar has about 300,000 people in population, but it is the wealthiest per capita in the world, according to purchasing power parity. This wealth has come from its natural gas riches.
The background.
Qatar is known to be the biggest exporter of liquefied natural gas.
The argument.
It's about finding new sources of revenue that don't rely on oil. Of course, natural gas will continue to be a very large component of its export revenue, and they believe that they will continue to produce at this level for 135 years, but they need to get into more tourism, more services.
For more on Qatar or other quick takes, go to BloombergView.com/quicktake, or for terminal customers, go to NI Quick. I'm Charlie Pellett, Bloomberg Radio.
You're listening to Bloomberg Best on Bloomberg Radio.
I'm June Grosso.
And I'm Ed Baxter.
After the Brexit vote last year, global financial institutions began to consider a move to mainland Europe as the realities of England's departure from the EU started to sink in. Despite these concerns, London Stock Exchange CEO Xavier Rowlett says there's nothing to worry about. He spoke earlier with Bloomberg's Anna Edwards.
Are you already losing any business because of concerns that Euroclearing will be forcibly moved from London into the Eurozone?
Well, not at all, but I think if you look at our first quarter earnings, you can see that flows are actually increasing and quite substantially. So that's not the case. But I would say several things. Is that the political case, it is not an economic or systemic or regulatory case. The political case that has been made by some to extract out of the global engine that is in London, as you pointed out, that is cleared by the London Clearing House, which today clears almost 95% of the world's over-the-counter derivatives. The political that has been made about the case does not fully comprehend the increase in systemic risk that is mathematically verifiable that would result from extracting from this global pool the euro-denominated pool pertaining to EU-based institutions, which, by the way, only represents 7% of the total. So you'd end up, and this is important to understand, with a very small, fragmented pool. Systemic risk would be increased because collateral management would, of course, be shared with far fewer entities, just European banks.
There are some in Europe, though, that think that it's a risk they don't want to bear, having all of this euro clearing taking place on the doorstep but not directly supervised by the EU, because they fear that they can't necessarily rely on swap lines between the relevant central banks always operating without the necessary regulatory control.
First of all, it's not a London Stock Exchange Group issue. We operate clearing houses and infrastructure around the world, so in the Eurozone as well as the UK, the US and Asia. But let's go back to that point. It's an important point. If the EU were uncharacteristically, the United States, for example, have no issues with US-denominated products being cleared in the UK. By the way, that represents 60% of the total flows. EU flows only represent 28% of total flows. And only a quarter of that 28% originates from the EU. So if the EU were to extract somehow through regulation, by the way, which all would have to agree to, and in the absence of a determined regulatory framework. There's still a debate as to whether, even in the EU, as to whether it should be the ECB that regulates this business or the national central bank. There's still a regulatory framework that is less than fully formed and certain. But if the EU were to somehow separate this, you'd end up with a very illiquid, which means riskier from a systemic perspective, far more costly. We have costed that based on a very rigorous analysis. This would cost in the region of 20 billion euros a year of additional margin, a cost that over 5 years, obviously, the math is simple.
You've been writing about that quite a lot recently. Can I ask you another question about the future then and opportunities? Do you see big opportunities in Saudi Arabia, for example, where you've just been with the Prime Minister? Are you still in the running for the Saudi Aramco?
Well, IPO? I'm not going to make any comments about it specifically. I want to make one last point about the clearing point, and it's an important one. If the EU somehow, through some political preference or priority, were to decide to create an isolated, fragmented, illiquid, and smaller pool of EU-originated, euro-denominated clearing flow, it would also, in our view, do lasting damage to the European Union and Eurozone members' desire to make the euro a global reserve currency. Because, of course, protectionism cuts both ways. And that would be the end of the euro as a global reserve currency. Now, I'll get to your other points. We have seen, and I think our first quarter numbers have shown, amazing growth in all our businesses, including in our IPO businesses. So more than ever, exchanges like the London Stock Exchange underpin the need for diversifying sources of capital raising for the benefits of small companies, startups, scale-up, big companies as well.
Still looking for business in Saudi.
Very, very attractive as a global IPO platform.
That was London Stock Exchange CEO Xavier Rowlett speaking with Bloomberg's Anna Edwards.
And coming up, we'll have the latest on a potential OPEC production cut with the Nigerian energy minister.
You can see all the Bloomberg Best Stories at Best Go. This is Bloomberg.
With the Bloomberg Business of Sports Report, I'm Michael Barr. The owner of the Miami Marlins may have to cut the price to sell the baseball team or take it off the market altogether. That's according to the New York Post. A source told the newspaper neither of the two bidding groups, including one with the Yankees' great Derek Jeter and former Florida Governor Jeb Bush, have met the $1.3 billion asking price. Tennis star Serena Williams would join the board of online polling provider SurveyMonkey. Williams is expected to advocate for diversity at the company and throughout Silicon Valley. Also on the board is Intuit CEO Brad Smith. Facebook Chief Operating Officer Sheryl Sandberg is also on the board, where her late husband David Goldberg was CEO. It's the most lucrative shoe deal ever for an NFL player. New York Giants wideout Odell Beckham Jr. has signed a deal with Nike that could pay Beckham $48 million over 8 years. And that is a Bloomberg Business of Sports report. I'm Michael Barr.
It's 48 minutes past the hour, and now it's time for Bloomberg View.
I'm Jonathan Bernstein, a columnist for Bloomberg View. The extent to which out parties almost always gain ground in midterm elections is a good reminder that winning elections just doesn't tell you very much about a party's readiness to govern. Some parties, including Republicans in 1981 and Democrats in 2009, are prepared, but not all of them. Which brings us to the Republican Party in 2017. Republican electoral gains while Barack Obama was in the White House were impressive. So is, unfortunately, what appears to be their appalling inability to formulate public policy. The budget Donald Trump submitted to Congress this week, whatever one thinks of the ideology behind it, simply doesn't add up. The House passed a health care bill weeks before the Congressional Budget Office published its analysis, and those were the things that were going well. This is hardly inherent in conservative ideology. No one called Republicans in the 1980s incapable of discussing public policy. But as long as Republican groups are satisfied with their party's current level of dysfunction, the party will continue to deliver it. I'm Jonathan Bernstein. For more View, please go to BloombergView.com or View Go on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Thank you, Jonathan. And now let's check in with the Bloomberg affiliates to find out what's happening on the nation's most influential radio stations.
I'm Ed Corey. On WWJ in Detroit, I'm reporting Ford has announced a series of changes in its senior leadership ranks.
I'm Larry Kofsky, and on Bloomberg 99.1, I'm reporting on the return of Banana Republic to Baltimore's Inner Harbor.
I'm Elisa Parenti. On WBBM in Chicago, I'm reporting on Boeing securing a government contract to produce a space plane.
I'm Courtney Donahoe on KTRH in Houston. Westinghouse has already received buyer interest and is expected to start talks this summer.
Thank you, Courtney. Oil retreated today as OPEC members gathered in Vienna to discuss extending oil production cuts. Bloomberg's Manus Cranny is at the meeting, and he had the chance to speak with Nigeria's energy minister, Emmanuel Kachikwu.
Consensus seems to be a nine-month extension to the deal, but I'm also hearing that there's this additional 3 months. A, do you support the 9 months? And B, what is this additional 3 months Novak et al. Are talking about?
Well, so certainly I support the 9 months straight up. Because I think it gives a longer gestation period to see how prices move, how stocks stay, how the reserves in most countries are holding up. But the 12 months agenda is a conversation being had along a longer term type extension. And the reason why most people are lining around it is that if we know ahead of time that in 9 months' time when we do meet, we'll be able to have a 3 months further review, look at stocks, look at price, and look at behavior of the market. And then potentially roll over for additional 3 months, it helps with better planning. It gives a longer-term perspective to producers. But more important, that is the sort of calculation we're having in terms of what time it's going to take to be able to balance that market.
Is everybody on board?
On the 9 months, largely. On the 12 months, still conversational, as far as I know.
So it could still turn. Venezuela say the market will rebalance. I caught up with the minister in the lobby of the hotel here. Rebalance by the end of the year. The IEA are telling me that it will be in deficit by the end of the year. As you run the numbers, minister, what do you think for the end of the year? Rebalancing?
I'm not as aggressive as some of my colleagues. I'm looking at rebalancing more in the first quarter of next year. And so that's why I'm very supportive of the 9 months agenda, because it brings you right in the smack of the end of first quarter.
Are you sufficiently wary of U.S. shale? That's the proposition that some in OPEC are blinkered. They're not taking shale seriously enough in the United States. How do you look at it?
I think it's realistic to take them seriously. The reality is that each time we hedge out on numbers, that they try to close that in. But I think it's smart for purposes of calculation that you see what the behavior is looking like. And I think whether or not we keep blindsided about it, we do seriously, quite frankly, consider it in most countries. Now, are they going to long-term really be of such an impact? I'm one of those who are basically middle line. I think they've not fully exhausted their capacity to hurt us. But I think the longer-term impact on us will be very limited if we continue to behave the way we are responsibly within OPEC and non-OPEC members of this team.
You have an exemption. Yes. Nigeria has an exemption. Mm-hmm. You have begun loading again at Forcados. What is your production? What do we think that Nigeria is going to produce this year? And have you felt any pressure at this meeting to join the cuts or to have a cap?
Well, first, our production is still relatively roughly about 1.5 million barrels on an average. We've had spikes, you know, of higher levels, but when you take an average of the month, it's about 1.5. Still below the 1.8 that is expected to be the catch point. Forcados is beginning to load, but the reality is those are test loadings. We still need to repair a lot of the secondary infrastructure that were damaged by militancy. It will take us about 6 months to get there. But my projection is that between the 6 to 9 months window, we should be able, all things being equal, militancy remaining calm, you know, and the investments that are required being urgently done to repair the existing pipelines, we should get to the sort of figures that we had before, and which, if you knock off the condensates, will largely place in the 1.8 million barrels category. At that point, of course, right now we have a bit of subtle what's going on, but the secondary and primary sources justify that those are, our numbers don't justify us joining the pack yet. But quite frankly, when we do, the pressure is going to get on for us to join the cut team. And Nigeria is not averse to that, because I think everybody needs to make the necessary sacrifice to help both the price stability and worldwide on a worldwide basis.
That was Nigerian Energy Minister Emmanuel Kachikwu speaking with Bloomberg's Manus Krani. And now for a look at the other side of things, Bloomberg's Alex Steele spoke with David Rockcharlie, head of energy assets for KKR.
So the big question, of course, is you have oil rigs continuing to increase as OPEC production continues to come down. How does that resolve itself on the curve?
Right. I think the most important thing to think about is the oil companies are trying to make money, and they have money to spend. So the reality is they look at the forward curve for signals for when to invest their capital, but they are a growth business, and they're going to keep investing until they run out of money.
So when you look at a forward curve and you look at prices out in a year, they're around 50, 52. I'm trying to get a read on what level would stop that kind of shale production and oil rig increase.
Right. I think there's two things going on today. One is the oil companies think that they can make money at $50. So they're going to keep drilling at this curve. The other thing, which I know you're well aware of, there's been a lot of money invested in land, in mm-hmm. particular in the Permian Basin. The number over the last 2 years is about $40 billion. And you can't spend $40 billion on an asset that doesn't produce cash flow and just let it sit there.
How long does that story play out for? Because $40 billion, yes, but maybe not $40 billion in the next 9 months, for example, if the curve stays around 50.
Correct. So the $40 billion was spent with the idea that it gave them an opportunity to spend more once they acquired it. So I think the most important thing to realize is that the next year is probably not going to change a lot of people's minds if we're in this range. So I think the drilling plans are out there, and people are going to continue to drill and develop those assets they've acquired.
So what's your base case for 2018 then? We don't have an exit strategy from OPEC, but at some point you're going to have Russia and Saudi Arabia are going to want to get back their market share, right? While shale is still producing potentially 10 million barrels of oil a day. What's your base case for 2018 for that?
Right. So we're long-term investors, and we really don't focus as much on what's going to happen in 2017 and 18. But our view on base case today is that OPEC's looking for stability. That's what they do. I think we're actually seeing that in the market. Oil's been relatively stable. It's one of the reasons we've been able to invest. And so as I look at 17 and 18, I think it's going to be relative stability unless we see some demand or supply shock.
So you're in the Eagle Ford, not in the Permian. Why are you making that choice?
Right. Well, we've talked a lot about investing and what people's plans are for 17 and 18. We are investing, and we expect to continue actively investing, but we're doing something very different with our capital. We're actually buying existing production. So what we see in the industry today is a dynamic in the United States and North America in particular, where companies are continuing to focus on growth. And that growth comes from buying land, in particular in the Permian, and then investing capital in drilling to bring more production online. To finance that, they're going to the capital markets, which we've seen have been pretty mm-hmm. receptive in 15 and 16. It's actually slowed down significantly this year. Mm-hmm. And then secondly, they sell assets. So they sell assets that they feel are lower growth in order to invest in assets that are higher growth. And that's really good for us. We like acquiring assets that are being sold today that have a lot of current production. It gives us a really long-term approach to the business.
Is there an oil price or an oil curve that makes you say, I don't want to put money to work right now?
I think for us, there's two things we focus on. One is volatility. it's really hard for us to invest when things are volatile, because at the end of the day, we're in the partnership business. We work with other companies to develop or acquire assets, so those companies have to be willing to transact with us. So if prices move around a lot, it's hard for us to invest at all. But as long as there's stability, we can invest and we can hedge our production. We've become really good risk managers, frankly, in this industry. And it's one of the things that KKR focuses on is long-term risk management. So we're actually happy to invest generally at any price, as long as we feel good around the cycles. And we follow two things in the cycle, the industry fundamentals and then the capital markets fundamentals. And right now, both of those are working for us.
That was David Rockcharlie, head of energy assets at KKR, speaking with Bloomberg's Alex Steele.
That's all for this edition of Bloomberg Best.
If you have a Bloomberg terminal, you can see all the Bloomberg Best stories at Best Go.
Our show is produced by David Sucherman and Mark Siniscalchi.
I'm Ed Baxter.
And I'm June Grosso. This is Bloomberg.